BBC World Service. Chinese history is heavy. Two farmers heave a huge slab that once formed part of a 16th century fortress on the Great Wall.
Oh, so what does this say then? So here's a huge piece of marble with two Chinese characters on it. Yingxu.
Yingxu means greet the rising sun, something this slab hasn't done for 40 years. Communists decided the past was getting in the way of the future, and they tore the fortress down. When he isn't rescuing history, Mei Jingtian is in his fields. This is a scene which hasn't changed much in thousands of years. Mountains behind, blue sky above, and a forest of golden spears, harvesting maize with a scythe. China's deepest sense of itself lies in the land. In a few days' time, the Communist Party Congress will put in place a new generation of leaders for the next decade. I'm Carrie Gracie, and this programme is about history lessons they should learn from the Chinese people. Mr. Mei tells me the story of how his ancestors came to Shuxia village in the 17th century.
We're standing on a ridge looking down at a narrow pass with mountains rising steeply on either side. Mr. Mei's explaining the part his village played in a crucial moment of Chinese history. The year is 1644. Peasant rebel Li Zicheng is determined to sweep away the corrupt Ming dynasty, and only the Great Wall stands between him and the capital. Mr. Mei says the gates that guard the pass are impregnable from the front. But a farmer knows a secret tunnel just above us, and he shows it to the rebels. Li Zicheng and a small band of his bravest men then crawl through that tunnel. They scramble down the mountain and they attack the gate from the rear. Kill the guards, open the gate, and off they go, rebel army galloping through the pass to capture Beijing. It's a story with a sad ending for the village, though. Only a year later, Li Zicheng is overthrown and forced to retreat north through here again. He holds the locals responsible for the loss of some of his soldiers. So he rounds up the entire population, hundreds of people, and has them all slaughtered. Mr. Mei and the other families who live here now are descendants of those who moved in after the massacre.
Li Zicheng was just one peasant rebel to topple a dynasty. It's a familiar theme in Chinese history, according to Guo Baogang of Dalton State College in the United States.
It's the sense of hopelessness. Peasants have a very miserable life. There's a lot of famines and unemployment. Most peasants have no land. So they're very vulnerable to the utopian thinkers prescribing a perfect society as a way to escape from the existing society.
农民起义, 农民 meaning agricultural people, farmers, 起义, 起义 meaning to arise, and 义, righteously.
Kaiser Guo is a spokesman for China's biggest internet search engine, Baidu. He's very conscious of public opinion now and then.
Throughout history, we can see, for example, the peasant rebellion that brought an end to the tyrannical Qin dynasty in 3rd century BC, a peasant rebellion that nearly brought the Han dynasty to an end, the peasant rebellion that brought an end to the Mongol Yuan dynasty. All of these are instances where the people have risen righteously against oppressive rulers. They're passive actors through most of history, but they are considered necessary to keeping the dynasty in line.
The lesson for China's new leadership: make sure people have a stake in the system. Peter Boll of Harvard University picks up the tale of the rebellion against the first imperial dynasty, the Qin.
The story goes, there were some farmers who had been assigned to report for military duty. And like everyone else in Qin, they had deadlines. And if you didn't meet a deadline, you would be punished. And they were making several days' journey, and they got caught in a storm in a swamp, and they realized they would not make the deadline, and that they would be punished with execution if they showed up. So they said, well, if we're going to die, let's just try to overthrow the whole system. And the rebellion began with them.
Tiananmen Square on a sunny day with lots of people from all over the country enjoying the heart of their capital. They certainly don't look like rebels, but there is lots of security here just in case, like the two soldiers beside me in their sharply creased green uniforms. I am about to do something that I've been avoiding for nearly 30 years of coming to China. I'm queuing up to see the body of Chairman Mao. And while I'm waiting, I'm staring at the Great Hall of the People, where China's new leadership will be unveiled in a few days' time. Their focus, of course, is on the future, but right in front of their eyes is this huge piece of the past, Chairman Mao's mausoleum in the middle of the square, and his portrait beaming down from Tiananmen Gate. Mao is the ultimate rebel, the leader of a peasant army who fought his way to power. When he announced the new republic, Mao claimed to speak for the people. Many Chinese believed him, and he did unite the country and stand up to foreigners. But soon, the people's hero began to behave like an emperor. And not just any emperor, the formidable Qin Shi Huang, the man who first united China.
We're told that he was ruthless. He got rid of anybody who shows opposition or didn't agree with him.
Sun Zhou is a historian from Hong Kong University.
Of course he's paranoid. He's constantly in fear, you know, how he could control this vast new territory and with so many different cultures, different groups of people.
The Qin was really the first state to go into total mobilization for war. And it saw really the work of its population as being fighting and soldiering to win wars and expand. But the Qin proceeds to conquer the other states. And I say it, we wouldn't have a China without the Qin, because it's really the first true empire, a centralized bureaucratic empire.
So what lessons from 2,000 years ago for the new leadership? Absolutism and the use of force are hard habits to break. Some would say the price of uniting such a vast and diverse country. Mao himself observed that power comes from the barrel of a gun.
Communist China readopted the imperial model. Emperor is absolute, and the only way to rule such a vast empire is ruthlessness.
There's actually an interesting quote from Chairman Mao about Qin Shi Huangdi. Mm-hmm. When comparing himself with Qin Shi Huangdi, he said, well, he only buried 460 scholars alive. Yeah. We've buried 46,000 scholars alive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You intellectuals revile us for being Qin Shi Huang. You're wrong. We've surpassed him 100-fold.
Yes, yeah, that's a very famous quote. Mao always see himself as better than Qin Shi Huangdi. He could do so much better.
But why would people put up with this megalomania? Why would they allow themselves to be placed on a permanent war footing or allow their scholars to be persecuted?
China's always been like that. Because this, I would say, it comes from the Confucianism.
Yang Shu is a cinematographer who's worked on several historical films.
The emperor, the minister, the father, the son, that's the order of the society. You, if you belong to the lower rank, you don't have any right to say anything. And you've been ruled by your father. And your father ruled by the ministers. And then by the king. So the society's always been like that. It's not only the present government. It's just mostly in the culture.
Back in Shuxia village, Mei Jingtian's grandchildren are playing on the old threshing floor. And he's off again in search of history. He leads me through walnut trees and sunflowers to a well, which he says may be even older than the fortress and the Great Wall.
I'm trying to see the bottom of this well. Apparently it's all marble at the bottom. Mr. Mei was just explaining to me that they used to say that when they were digging this well, if you dug out a bucket of sand, you would be given a bucket of silver. It was so hard to dig. I cannot see the bottom. I'm just going to throw a stone in and see how long it takes to drop. completely dry. And the problem with that is the climate is drying out and desertification is increasing here. There's simply not enough water. It used to be, even up to about 20 years ago, that if it rained a lot in this area, this well would absolutely fill with water and it'd be pouring out the top. But nowadays, it's dry to the very bottom.
Some historians have described China as being a kind of hydraulic society, that the control of water is absolutely everything.
Francis Wood is curator of the Chinese collection at the British Library.
You know, you have these great river systems. The Yellow River picks up huge amounts of this yellow earth. And so you get the river silting up and it will occasionally burst its banks. And when it bursts its banks, it crosses thousands of miles of agricultural land, sweeping people before it. And that's happened 10, 15, 20 times in Chinese history. Then you get breakup, disunion, rebellion, and so on.
This fear is something that comes up again and again, even in contemporary Chinese politics, that, you know, analysts both inside and outside China will say, well, the Chinese public will put up with quite a lot because when they look at the alternative, they fear the idea of disunity.
Yes, I think that's very, very strong. Don't rock the boat. I mean, a lot of people, you know, would rather almost anything than getting to a position where there might be a breakup of central power, because it's a very frightening thought.
This is living history. In Shisha village, everyone over 75 gets a free lunch from the local government. There's a round table with about 10 people. Each has an airline-style tray in front of them. Stir-fried meat and veg with rice. The veteran here is a 90-year-old in a blue cotton jacket. He fought the Japanese in his youth. His name is Jiang Sengqi. He says he joined up with the communists. The Japanese captured him and he thought they were going to kill him, but he managed to convince them he was only a farmer, so they let him go. This old lady says girls had to hide or they'd be raped by Japanese soldiers. But it wasn't just Japanese soldiers who made life miserable for Chinese women. In the old days, Li Shulan says, men ruled and women were chattels. She herself was sold into domestic service at the age of 6, and she got no schooling. Oh, heavens, the lyrics of this song are depressing. How miserable it is to be a woman, to be looked down upon from birth, to be thrown away or given away. But then it turns. Sisters, let's unite and destroy the old order. Let's abolish arranged marriage. Let's fight for the day of liberation and win equality with men.
While the communists did give women a better deal and they promoted literacy and got rid of the landlords, many of these old people remember life before the revolution and remain grateful to the party.
So there are some people from the older generation with me in this huge queue to see Mao's body. But to be in Tiananmen Square is to experience the contradiction at the heart of Chinese politics. The colours, the cameras, the hairstyles, the baseball caps. Everyone is making their own individual fashion statement here. It is just so different from the uniformity and the self-denial of Mao's day. So is the history lesson a paradox? That the public wants self-expression, but they also want strong men. I say strong men because men is what they're going to get. Women have made a lot of progress since the days of child brides and foot binding, but women won't be in the leaders' lineup in the Great Hall of the People over there.
In Chinese thinking, women is seen as a danger, as a threat. Because in Chinese history, quite often women's fault who led to the downfall of the dynasty. And so female power is extremely dangerous.
Sun Zhou says there's a tendency to blame wives for the bad luck or bad judgment of their husbands. Take Mao and his wife, Jiang Qing.
There's lots of talk about Mao's fault, it was all because of his wife. Jiang Chen. It was not Mao's fault. His only mistake was he listened to Jiang Qin in his old age. But in fact, Jiang Qin was just Mao's tool. Mao was the one who was really behind all of it. But this is how, you know, Chinese see women.
The negative stereotype has only been reinforced over recent months. Jonathan Fenby has written a history of modern China.
And then you've got the case of Bo Xilai's wife, Gu Kaili, this year, who doesn't have anything like this kind of political clout. But the whole story of the poisoning of the British businessman in a hotel, what went on, her defending her son, it fits into a kind of a minor dragon lady, minor Lady Macbeth scenario there. So you have this running throughout China.
China's first heavy metal band, a tribute to a golden age 1,300 years ago, the Tang Dynasty. Kai Sukuo, the internet guru we heard from earlier, founded this band.
When I settled on the name Tang Dynasty, it was because I understood well the associations with that particular dynasty. If you were to grab any kid off the street and ask him what was the greatest dynasty in China's history, 9 out of 10 of them would answer the Tang and ask why. Part of the reason they would give was because there was a real ethic of cosmopolitanism, you know, almost a fetish for things foreign. Representations in art of foreign merchants, of camel caravans, and all sorts of things exotic. And it was precisely because of this openness, this receptiveness to foreign ideas, including religions like Buddhism, to foreign arts. Subconsciously, subliminally, I think people would understand that a band working in an entirely foreign idiom, calling itself Tang Dynasty, was meant to evoke that same spirit.
I'm approaching Mao's mausoleum now, and the loudhailer's just telling us to get our passports ready for the last security check. On either side of this river of people, there are huge stone sculptures, the worker, soldier, peasant heroes of the revolution. But there is no memorial. Indeed, there is no trace of another attempt at revolution, the peaceful student one that happened 40 years later. In 1989, one of the leaders of the Tiananmen protest, Liu Xiaobo, wrote, "Enough of emperors."
For several thousand years, Chinese society has been living in a vicious cycle of a new emperor replacing an old emperor. History has proven that when an unpopular leader steps down and a popular leader steps up, this does not solve the essential problems of Chinese politics. What we need is not a perfect savior, but a perfect democratic system.
Liu Xiaobo has since won a Nobel Peace Prize, but is in prison for subversion. The Communist Party has exchanged personality cults for collective leadership and offered the people a deal. One party rule in exchange for the good life. I don't think I've ever seen a TV bigger than the one in Song Aiping's front room. Bathroom, central heating, refrigerator, the key comforts of city life have come to Shuxia Village. Life now is good, but when we get on to history, her eyes fill with tears. Her father was a school teacher, and in 1966, during the political frenzy of the Cultural Revolution, his own pupils denounced him as a counter-revolutionary. Song Aiping remembers watching in terror at struggle sessions where they hauled him on stage and beat him. In the end, he could bear the shame no longer, and he hanged himself. Her husband, Wang Mangang, says if it hadn't been for those decades of extremism, China would be much more developed now.
Economic growth was used to make China great and for the Communist Party to be able to say, we brought you the revival of China and material growth, and therefore we deserve to rule China.
Jonathan Fenby.
I'm not sure that that argument will play all that well to a generation which wasn't brought up under Mao and which has known relatively good times. You don't have elections. Officials are appointed in nearly all cases, and even village elections are pretty much decided in advance. So the only way of making your feelings felt is to go out on the streets.
But Kaiser Guo of internet search engine Baidu says ordinary Chinese, old hundred names as they're known, are just beginning to get their feelings across.
Today, we're seeing, really for the first time, the Lao Bai Xing, the old hundred names, able to articulate their ideas in a public sphere. Now, while internet penetration is only at about 40%, that does now include an awful lot of people who have very ordinary jobs working in cities or in county towns, even, and even plenty of people who are engaged in agriculture. Their voices are now heard in cyberspace, at least, and that has come to function as a kind of public sphere that China has never, in its very long history, actually had.
Which is an amazing development, isn't it, really? Because, I mean, absolutely, other countries have had various different platforms for, quote, ordinary people. But as you say, this is really the first one for Chinese ordinary people.
That's right. I think that this is absolutely unprecedented, and it has given the Chinese leadership itself a vantage point on the feelings of ordinary citizens that perhaps counterintuitively has made it a more responsive and deliberative and participatory leadership.
Just going up the steps and about to go into the mausoleum now. There's a sign which says, please keep quiet and take off your hat. Very quiet and patient everybody is. A lot of people carrying flowers. I just bought them just before we came up the steps. We're being ushered along quite fast. Roped off corridor of carpet. I can't believe I'm just about to do this. So here we are actually looking at the body. I'm supposed to be quiet. So the body's inside a glass case. There's lots of guards. The atmosphere is a bit like a funeral. There's a hammer and sickle flag on the body.
Gosh, that was quick. I'm out the other side already, blinking in the sunshine. When Mao died, his successors said the radiance of his thought would last forever. But Mao suits are gone. Mao Zedong thought is barely mentioned today. It takes people literally 10 minutes to pay their respects to the chairman here. And already on the steps of his mausoleum, there are two girls in high heels and hot pants posing for pictures. The new leadership will be in charge for 10 years. And China's new wealth and status gives Xi Jinping and his team an opportunity. The history lesson: if you want China to move beyond its age-old cycle of ruthlessness and rebellion, start work now on a new relationship with the people. From me, Carrie Gracie, and the producer, Neil Rizal, thanks to you for listening.